Congress's newest member comes from South Florida. The race to replace a school superintendent and driving again soon on Ocean Drive. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Sheila Sherfillis McCormick will be the newest member of Congress representing parts of Broward and Palm Beach counties. She won a special election this week, giving Democrats one more vote on Capitol Hill. The Congresswoman-elect will join us this hour. And then the resumes are in to become the next superintendent of schools in Miami-Dade County. But critics worry the process to find the next boss is moving too fast. Plus, pedestrians took over some streets during the pandemic, including Ocean Drive in Miami Beach. That road will welcome back some cars soon. Can the push to make some neighborhoods more friendly to walkers last? The program's made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. The newest member of the United States Congress comes from South Florida. Sheila Sherfillis McCormick is the Congresswoman-elect from Florida's 20th district, straddling Broward and Palm Beach counties. She succeeds longtime Congressman Alcee Hastings, who died in April. Her win gives Democrats a 10-vote majority now in the House of Representatives. So let's say hello to the Congresswoman-elect. Welcome to WLRN, Congresswoman-elect. Nice to have you.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
There we go. Now we can hear you. I apologize for that little technical glitch. Congratulations on your victory.
Thank you so much. We're super excited to what the future has to hold for us.
We got a lot to talk about because the future is going to come very fast for you as a Congresswoman-elect. During the campaign, you said that you would push for ideas that lead to economic equity. What are some of those that you are going to champion on Capitol Hill as soon as you are sworn in?
Well, one of the things that we're committed to fighting for is our People's Prosperity Plan, in which we're looking for a more equitable way for people to recover from COVID-19, especially right now as we're in the pandemic. In our district, we have a lot of people, including a large population of our seniors, who could use direct payments to help to pay for some of their housing need. Housing is such a huge issue for us in our district. So if we were able to give them at least an economic stimulus check of $1,000 until there's more economic stability and until we understand how we're moving forward with the pandemic, and then we also have some people who are actually younger people who can't go to work because they are sick. And so we need to find some kind of way to help our district and the nation recover from COVID while we're just waiting for everything to balance out and while we're waiting for the Build Back Better plan to pass, just to make sure we have some kind of ways to recover.
There have been two rounds of stimulus checks already during this pandemic. You're advocating for a third round of stimulus checks. Specifically or more generally, the universal basic income, a proposal that's part of your prosperity plan, the $1,000 a month payment from the government to people making $75,000 a year or less?
Well, we're advocating for kind of a dual program where it's going to be stimulus checks for the duration of any kind of pandemic issues, based issues, economic issues. For example, right now we see that there are uncertainties and we've been waiting for relief into the community from the Build Back Better plan and it hasn't happened. But we are aware that we have huge housing shortages throughout the entire country. So while we're trying to find a way to fill that gap, we need to have something present, something to deliver to the community and to the entire country so people can actually stay in their homes with dignity, so our elderly can actually have a chance at finding simple things such as paying for their electricity, even eating. We find it hard for a lot of seniors too. And also with the shortage of healthcare, there's a lot of seniors who don't have access to healthcare the way they need it, or even paying for prescriptions. So right now, what I'm advocating for is that even if we had a window of basic income, if we had a pilot program that would last maybe 3 or 6 months, so we can help people actually be more secure in their homes, then we'll actually be doing what the people need right now.
There has been little appetite in Congress for the kind of universal basic income that you spoke about during the campaign. In terms of another COVID stimulus round, there has been no real public effort for that. Do you have legislation ready that you're going to introduce that you're going to try to bring to the Democratic caucus?
Yes, we do. We have the People's Prosperity Plan, but also we plan on signing on to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's plan, the Support Act. And although there hasn't been a real appetite for it, but looking at how we're moving closely towards in the future, looking at some of the economic insecurities that we have, looking at the pandemic, we really have to start taking a hard look at what's going on in our country, and we have to take a hard look at what our constituents really need. And as I mentioned, there's a financial boost that is necessary right now as we're trying to figure out how we overcome housing issues, inflation, and the other issues that are going on when it comes to our financial needs.
Many economists will say you don't fight inflation with more money, though, but rather with higher interest rates. That's the way the Federal Reserve has decided to tackle inflation historically, and it looks like it will be doing that here this year.
That's correct, but what we're looking at is prioritizing the needs of the people first before we could fight inflation. Right now, the people are in need. Right now, we saw that with the past holidays that many people in my district couldn't even afford to buy groceries. They stood in long lines waiting for turkey giveaways. So how do we meet the present needs of the people who depend on the government right here and today? And that's what we're concerned with. How do we make sure that we don't have people who are being turned out in the street? There was a woman in my district who has four daughters who was homeless. She did qualify for a voucher. She had a voucher, Section 8 voucher, but she could not find a place that would accept her voucher because it was too low. And she's many of the people in my district. So what do we do for those people? Do we allow them to sleep in the street right now? Or do we do something proactive to help everyone and prevent that? And that's why I'm looking towards direct payments to help prevent any kind of economic stress or even homelessness that we have in the district.
We are speaking with Congresswoman-elect Sheila Sherfilis-McCormick, elected this week to the 20th Congressional District, straddling Broward and Palm Beach counties. 800-743-WLRN, our phone number, if you'd like to speak with the Congresswoman-elect. 800-743-WLRN. You can also join us on social media. We're monitoring our handle, at WLRN. Congresswoman-elect, you are a Democrat. Do you plan on being a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Well, because I believe in progressive policies, and I believe that the Progressive Caucus is putting forth policies that really meet the needs of the people, especially right now. And when we look at working people, what they're suffering, it's imperative that we have a champion voice. I also look forward to joining other caucuses, such as the Congressional Black Caucus. So I'm looking forward to working with many different caucuses, but every member in Congress, so we can get the people's work done.
How does the Progressive Caucus impact the Democrats' ability to pass legislation that can also get support from Senate Democrats?
Well, I think that it's going to take us being able to speak more and negotiate because right now we see a lot of negotiations that are going on, which is very healthy. But as we continue to open up the lines of communication, we'll be able to push more legislation. But I don't think it's really just going to be towards one caucus group. I think it's everyone's responsibility to work it out and actually fight for the people and put people first.
This caucus, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, last week endorsed a bill that would expand the United States Supreme Court beyond the current 9 justices to 13. Do you support such an effort?
No, I do not.
And why not?
I think right now, if we keep going into expanding the justices, I think it's a slippery slope. I think we should stay where we are and kind of work within the means. And so that's why I'm slow to move forward in support of that.
So on the high court, making some news in the last 24 hours, certainly, the Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration's effort to mandate employees of companies with 100 or more workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Do you support such a mandate for workers?
Yes, I think that we have to start making sure that we're taking control of the pandemic. And that's really going to come with us encouraging people to have mandates and encouraging people to take the vaccine. If we keep going in this pace where we have so many people who are being exposed to different types of variants, then I'm afraid of what the future is going to lie and what's going to happen. But I think as we start promoting vaccination education, as we start letting people know why you must be vaccinated and actually increasing vaccinations in our country, we'll see that our future will be brighter than us allowing or sitting back and allowing no rules being in place.
The majority opinion that struck down this OSHA rule, the Occupational Safety Hazard Administration, that put this rule into place, essentially argued that it was overstepping its bounds, that it went way beyond the workplace and overstep some of the congressional authority. Is this a place that you would advocate Congress to act?
Yes. Yes, I would. And I think it's very important that we ensure that we come out this pandemic strong and we don't go backwards. And as we see, there are multiple different variables that are coming every day. We're hearing about a new one. And we have to take real affirmative steps to protect every citizen and to protect our country.
The court, in a separate ruling, let stand a requirement of healthcare facilities receiving federal money to have workers vaccinated, hospitals, nursing homes, and those types of facilities. You're the CEO of a home healthcare company that receives Medicare money, I believe. Are your employees vaccinated?
Yes. We took it very seriously. And so our employees actually volunteered and were taking affirmative steps to be vaccinated. So we were very happy about that because we saw in the beginning of the pandemic that our employees were getting sick. And they were getting sick, their families were getting sick. And so they actually took the onus on themselves to go out and be vaccinated. So we didn't have to pressure or advocate or put any rules in place. So we're hoping that more people in healthcare will recognize the need to protect themselves as well as their patients.
So your company did not mandate that employees get vaccinated, but rather you had 100% volunteer for the COVID-19 vaccinations?
At first, we had close to 85% because some people were a little bit leery, but especially with the Delta variant, when the Delta variant started rearing its head, that's when most people got very concerned and they started actually vaccinating. So it has been more of a staggered approach, but at this point, everybody has been vaccinated.
Sheila, sir, do you require a vaccination as a condition of employment now?
No, we don't. We don't require it right now.
But you will now with the Supreme Court ruling, is that correct?
We would have no problem complying with whatever rules that are in place, but our priority has always been to educate our employees and for us to have an environment where we talk about what is best for the safety of our employees and what is best for the safety of our patients. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say the vaccination information is very crucial, because when we started having more of the conversations, when we started actually even putting out the evidence of what the vaccination does, and as they saw, as they got more confident in the vaccination, we saw more people being vaccinated.
I see.
And so I think that that's why education is so important, especially in the workplace. It's important to have that kind of clear dialogue and not cross boundaries when it comes to healthcare, but make sure that it's available for every employee.
Congresswoman-elect Sheila Sherfilis McCormick is with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Jay in Hollywood is listening and has a question, Congresswoman-elect. Jay, thanks for calling and listening. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, good morning. The promise of the $1,000 stimulus check, you know, is some believe that that's a way to get people's attention. But instead of focusing so much on giving people $1,000, wouldn't it be a better to focus on trying to help people maybe get a better education, getting more educated and better job, being more equipped for the job, something that's going to help them on the long term versus just a stimulus?
Jay, thanks for the question. Congresswoman-elect?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And that's why we have more prongs than just our $1,000. It's funny because part of our campaign has always been job development. I've been able as a CEO, formerly as a CEO, to be able to create more than 1,000 jobs throughout the entire state. In addition to that, we also have a vocational school. So I've seen personally how when you couple vocational training with job opportunities and companies, you see people on the long term actually start their trajectory totally changes. Where now, instead of being cemented into poverty, they actually have a new avenue and they're growing. So we want to make sure when we talk about economic justice, that every opportunity that comes with federal finances and federal money, that our district has a chance at it. And what that looks like is that, I'll give you an example, mm-hmm. with the infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. In the infrastructure bill, there's gonna be a lot of different contracts there. And we wanna make sure that all small businesses have the same advantages, the same opportunities to have some of those contracts, and that they're employing within the district. And that's gonna stimulate a lot of jobs. And we also wanna take some of our money that we have from our community initiatives, which is similar to the earmarking process, and institute some continuing education programs and some programs to connect our constituents with jobs. So that is definitely our priority, and that's definitely what we've been working on.
So if I'm hearing you correct, Congresswoman-elect, on the federal infrastructure spending legislation, which has passed and President Biden has signed into law, when it comes to any projects that that are in the 20th Congressional District, you would like to see those projects come with a requirement of a certain amount of hiring of people who reside within the boundaries of the 20th Congressional District?
Well, right now, since the bill has been passed, we don't really have input on the bill. But what we can do is be that liaison between our constituents, where we can help demystify the rules, the application process within our office as we're doing casework to help more people in our district have access to it. Because even getting access to these grants and even these jobs is extremely complicated. And for people within the district and within the state, actually, it's difficult for them to gain access. So we want to start with our initiative through our casework to demystify on how you apply. In addition to that, any future legislation that's coming in that we know will be coming down, we want to ensure that there's clauses in it that state that you have to be hiring certain contractors who actually live within the district, and you have to be hiring certain employees who live within the district or within the work zones, so we can start stimulating jobs and small businesses.
Let me ask you about another significant issue this week, and will continue for the foreseeable future, certainly. Certainly. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed voting legislation along party lines. The legislation approved by the House and sent to the Senate would create national voting access standards, such as same-day voter registration. It would set a minimum number of early voting days, and it would allow voters to vote by mail for any reason. Do you support the legislation that was passed out of the House?
I support it 100%. And I support it so strongly because during this election, we saw actual real signs in people trying to put on voter suppression tactics. For example, at the African American Library and also at the E. Pat Larkin Center, which is named after one of our civil rights heroes, we had Proud Boys who were over there. They were throwing up the white supremacy sign. They called the police on a lot of workers just to increase any kind of form of police presence, hoping to intimidate and drive people not to vote. Now, if we look at
how would this legislation affect that kind of behavior, though?
Well, what we're trying to do right now is ensure that everyone can exercise their right to vote, because there's an escalation that's occurring. And so the reason why I brought that up is that if we don't put real safeguards in place that allow people to go vote, what's going to end up happening is that these tactics are going to increase and our availability to vote is going to decrease. And that's where you have a real issue when it comes to having proportionate representation for people in our district and all over the country.
Understand, but the legislation passed out of the House, how would that affect the instance that you gave us the example of essentially demonstrators protesting of some kind near a polling place?
Well, it's white supremacist groups who are out there. So if we understand
Fair
that
enough.
many states are actually rolling back the right for people to vote. Right? Many states are actually making it more difficult for working class people to vote. And when you combine that with white supremacist organizations, the effect is damaging. So the first step is ensuring that, first of all, that we have access to voting, that the hours are there, that we have early voting, that it's actually convenient to vote. And then the next step, the following step, has to be that we ensure that we don't allow for any kind of terrorist organization to be around the polls and be allowed to call the police. And so that's why we have to take these steps now for Voting Rights Act to follow it up quickly with other measures.
Voting rules historically have been left to individual states. This would set federal standards. Why federalize voting rules?
Because we need to make sure that everyone in the United States will be free, can live free without any kind of intimidation or any kind of possibility of rolling back our voting rights. And we've been seeing a systematic rolling back of voting rights, especially that target working class people and minorities. And so that right now the federal government has to make it standard.
Congresswoman-elect, we got one more call here from Pembroke Pines. Terrence is listening in. Terrence, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Congresswoman-elect. I had a twofold question. One was the work that Congressman Hastings did. Is there anything afoot to do any type of legacy project in his memory? And then secondly, for small businesses like me, what kind of things do you see in the pipe for support to continue to try to grow out of COVID as we, you know, figure out our way through this pandemic?
Thanks for the call, Terrence. Congresswoman-elect?
Well, we definitely have been looking at which one of the late Alcee Hastings policies that we are going to be inheriting. We do have inheritance rights where we can inherit his bills and we inherit some of his budget and his offices. But there's one piece of legislation that we saw that he was pushing for that is still relevant today. And that is increasing diversity and minorities in different positions in the federal government. So that is one that we are really looking to adopt and to put forth. And we also later on down the road would like to commemorate the late Alcee Hastings, where we have the opportunity to tell the district story about what kind of leader he was in our district and to preserve it. Now, as for small businesses, there's a lot of different issues that we're finding with our small businesses. And it's not just revenue, but like I mentioned earlier, it's having access to federal programs, especially where you're no longer the subcontractor, where you have an opportunity to be a prime. And with that, we have to make sure that there are actually loans and funding available, because a lot of times when you get these contracts, you have to be able to cover your payroll and expenses until you're reimbursed. So creating those opportunities through different working programs federally with the SBA we're working on. And we're also working to see if there's any banks that we can incentivize banks to start helping smaller businesses have that funding so they can be able to take on larger contracts.
SBA is the government agency, the Small Business Administration. Finally, Congresswoman-elect, when do you expect to be sworn into office?
Right now, we're looking at Tuesday.
Tuesday, waiting for the Florida Secretary of State to certify the results of the election this week. I believe that's the final step, and then the swearing in?
Yes. Well, right now, I'm able to be sworn in with the unofficial results. And the unofficial results I know was sent from Broward County and I believe Palm Beach yesterday afternoon. And so the next time when we'll actually be in session will be on Tuesday. So that's why that Tuesday date it should be the right proper time.
Well, the next time we speak, it'll be Congresswoman then. Congratulations again and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to working with you soon.
Sheila Sir Phyllis McCormick, Congresswoman-elect from Florida's 20th Congressional District here on the South Florida Roundup. Stick with us. We got plenty more to talk about, including the race to replace a schools superintendent in Miami-Dade County. That is coming up next. Stick with us. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 16 people want to be the next superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. That's how many people have applied for the job, and they did so by Wednesday at 5 p.m., the deadline set by the school board for job applications to be submitted. Now, the board is next scheduled to meet on Tuesday to discuss its next steps as it looks to replace Alberto Carvalho, who will leave February 3rd to become the superintendent of schools in Los Angeles, California. Critics have been complaining this process to choose the boss of the nation's fourth largest school district and Miami-Dade's largest employer is moving too fast. Candidates had 7 days to turn in their credentials to be considered. By contrast, Broward County Public Schools has had an interim superintendent since August and continues searching for a permanent boss there. Join our conversation, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Miami-Dade County Public School Board Vice Chair Dr. Steve Gallen back with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Dr. Gallen, nice to have you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And great to spend time with you as well. You supported this quick timeline, or the timeline that's been characterized as quick. Why?
I think the timeline, I was in full support of the timeline. I think we are very clear as it relates to the sense of urgency that we have around this particular replacement. But more importantly, I think it's lost that this is not a new conversation for the board. The board has had extensive discussions, quite frankly, relative to succession management over the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that was done in isolation. This was not something that was done in a very episodic way. This has been a part of formal discussions by the board, formal public discussions regarding succession management.
So along those lines, the district has had a succession plan calling for a deputy superintendent to step in. Why not implement that plan?
That plan relative to the deputy replacing the superintendent was a recommendation by the superintendent. That was not a plan that was adopted and embraced by the board. So you have a superintendent's recommendation and you have a board's plan. So the board's plan at this particular time was not codified pursuant to what was recommended by the superintendent. And therefore the chair, having had extensive experience in this particular process, called for a special meeting. to get the board's input, and that's where we ended up with a 6-3 vote to move in the direction that we're moving.
Could that be interpreted as a vote of no confidence of the deputy superintendent?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. This was a decision relative to us making a decision around the qualifications, the criteria. And quite frankly, I think we are getting ahead of ourselves because the meeting was to determine that qualifications, timeline, and process. I think it has been mischaracterized as the board making a decision to replace the superintendent in 7 days, to hire a superintendent in 7 days. That was factually inaccurate. Factually inaccurate and inconsistent with the board's action.
It was 7 days in terms of the window for those interested to supply materials to be considered to replace Superintendent Carvalho, who will be leaving February 3rd. Do you expect to name and vote on a superintendent by February 3rd?
We're in the process right now of simply receiving the letters of interest, the resumes, and the supporting documentation. We have a meeting scheduled this coming Tuesday to discuss the materials and the applicants that we've received and potentially to discuss next steps. So we've not made a determination as it relates to when a vote will be taken.
Will any late applications be accepted?
The timeline was very clear. 5 o'clock on yesterday was the timeline.
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday, right. By the board. We received that material yesterday as a board, so we're in the process of deliberating over that. And once we review the candidates that we have, the board obviously will make a decision whether or not those candidates are acceptable. Listen, this is not new to the board. We've had that process with respect to chief auditor, with respect to other positions that the board has had to address. And when we look at the candidates, we can make a determination as it relates to whether or not those candidates meet the qualifications, meet the fit, and the board members can decide whether or not to move to the next step of this process.
Do you think that Miami-Dade County Public Schools' next superintendent is among the 16 applicants?
I will say we have some very strong candidates, and I have identified some individuals that have submitted their information that definitely can step into the role of superintendent.
You want to share those names with us, Dr. Gallen?
I'm just one vote. Those names that have submitted letters of interest have been made available to the public,
right.
All 14. So I don't think it would be prudent for me to identify those because I do have interviews scheduled. But we're looking at the initial documentation that has come in. Yes, we have some very qualified individuals that could step into the role of superintendent.
Dr. Gallen, let me ask for a clarification there. Did I mishear you? Did you say 14 applicants?
It was initially 16, and we had two that withdrew.
I see.
So the last count that I had was 14.
I see. Among the initial 16 applicants, you had said, by the way, we have the talent right here within the county. Six of the 16 original applicants currently work for the school district in some capacity. Another four have previous district experience.
Yes, absolutely. And I do believe that there's been a total mischaracterization relative to the distinction between the national search. What is implicit in that is a national search firm conducting the process. But we have districts around the country. It's not atypical for a school district to facilitate that process, but open it up nationally. We had an individual that has applied from as far as Canada.
Right.
So the opportunity was available for individuals not only throughout this country, but even abroad, as we have evidence through that process.
Well, recruiting for a job in Miami in January is, there's some good leverage there, meteorological leverage. Dr. Gallen, let me ask you a couple quick more questions here. How will a group of community leaders, including League of Women Voters, the South Dade NAACP, sent a memo asking the board to slow down the process. How will the board consider community voices in the selection process?
I think the community voices have been considered and continue to be considered in this particular process. We have open meetings. We had an opportunity at that meeting, in fact, to hear from the community, to have them to share their perspectives relative to the process and the criteria. And that communication is ongoing. We actually have a subsequent meeting coming up where, again, the community can render their support. So that process is ongoing. But at the end of the day, let's be honest, at the end of the day, with the community feedback, the ultimate authority and the decision making does come to the board.
Are you interested in the position, Dr. Gallen?
I think I've been asked that repeatedly.
I know you have.
I am eminently qualified for the position, having been a superintendent, having labored in the Miami-Dade County Public Schools for decades. But at this particular time, as I shared publicly, I'm not interested in being the superintendent of the Miami-Dade County Public Schools at this time. I'm going to honor the commitment that I made to the voters in District 1 who elected me most recently in 2020, and I'm looking forward to completing my term.
And then after completing that term, sounds like you're leaving the door open to an interest in the position.
I've been around long enough to know that man plan, God laughs.
Dr. Steve Gallen with us here on the South Florida Roundup, the vice chair of the Miami-Dade County Public School Board. Dr. Gallen, always a pleasure. Thanks for your perspective.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much and stay safe.
You as well. We're going to continue the conversation about the process to replace Miami-Dade County Public School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho with Mina Hosseini, Executive Director of PS305, that's an education nonprofit in Dade County, and James Lopez, Executive Director of Power U, a nonprofit youth leadership development group. James and Mina, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Cool. James, nice to have you as well. Can you hear us okay?
I can. Thanks for having me.
Terrific. Mina, let me start with you, and then James, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this as well. What do you think of the process laid out by the school board and what you just heard from Dr. Gallen in terms of justifying the timeline?
You know, I think it calls into question the approach around impartiality, around transparency. There's no reason why we should be spending 7 days looking for a candidate that's going to fulfill the seat to replace Alberto Carvalho. So what I would offer is that we want to see a process where community input is valued. We want folks who are involved and engaged in education to be able to uplift their issues, their concerns. I want to remind your listeners that 2022 school year, this school year was the first school year that we came back to a full in-person schoolhouse model. Mm-hmm. And so to hear from our educators, to hear from folks on the ground, I think is really important in this process as we think about the adaptive solutions that we need to consider going forward. And so what we're missing as a community from this process is a clear vision from the board in helping us understand what they are seeking in the next superintendent.
James, do you not think that is clear in the qualifications that have been published by the school board when they're looking for someone who has classroom experience, someone who has been a school principal, someone who has administrative experience, someone who has a minimum of a master's degree, for instance?
Yeah, well, so, you know, first and foremost, I do want to recognize that selecting a new superintendent during this moment is not an easy decision, and that the person who's coming in is going to have a tough road ahead. And, you know, to that point, I do want to commend the school board for ensuring that the criteria is what you just listed, especially someone who is an educator and in the classroom. And I have a lot of respect for Dr. Gallen, and I think there is a lot of good that has that's going to come from this process, but it is a challenging one. I do think, frankly, the process is rushed, and the way it has been rolled out and communicated in some ways is tone deaf given the political climate that we are all living in and the politicized nature of public education. And so naturally acts of calls of lack of transparency are going to come up, and I don't think that the school board took that into consideration enough.
The school board has released the names of those individuals that that have applied for the program. They held a public meeting this week. They're going to hold a public meeting on Tuesday. James, share with me a little bit more about your concerns of transparency and as you describe the politicalization of the environment, I suppose.
Yeah. So, you know, getting the community engaged in the process is an ongoing challenge. It's always going to be an ongoing process. I think first and foremost, it's a good opportunity for parents to get really involved and for students to at least understand what's happening. It's very difficult to have that if you have public meetings at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday when people are working, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that's one consideration. And I just think that in general, we should use this opportunity, which has not happened in over a decade, to over-communicate, to in some ways do what we need to do to say that we did not have a public process. And I think there's still a lot to be desired in that.
Mina, let me ask you about the timing of this. The succession plan comes during a Florida legislative session. Public education spending in K-12 schools in Florida is one of the largest pieces of the state budget. Is there a risk of a vacuum of leadership by stretching the timeline out if this process takes longer than what the school board has laid out currently?
So I would just offer that I think that what we risk now with all of the challenges that you outlined with funding shortfalls, with teachers not having access to teachers, there being shortages, is not bringing the community into this process to engage on and understand all of the challenges that our public schools face. And so a process that does not consider community input, I feel that it's short-sighted to not consider that, because there is a long-term consideration around safeguarding our public schools in Miami.
What do you make of the qualifications that have been published? We spoke a little bit about them just a moment ago: district-wide experience, master's degree minimum, school principal, classroom experience. Mina, are there other qualifications that you'd like to see in a superintendent candidate?
Thinking about ways in which leadership candidates have understood the social and emotional aspect of learning. So what background do folks have, may or may not have, in understanding human development, understanding the mental health considerations? Mm. I think those are some things that come to mind for me. But what I offer is that hearing from constituents, hearing from folks who are experiencing the challenges on a day-to-day basis, is what we could have created and offered in this process that we're not seeing.
James, how do you capture the community voice? We know that voicemails can be left for elected school board members, emails can be written, public meetings can be held. What other options would you like to put in front of the school board in terms of collecting and hearing the community voices?
The ones that always come to mind that are the most impactful are often the most time intensive and the least sexy, which are having more public meetings. It requires people actually reaching out, talking to people at their doors. Mm. It is having phone calls. It is having meetings that are publicly accessible at times when people may be off work. I think there's many ways outside of email or going to the district website, which sometimes people may have difficulty to navigate. Especially there's a huge population of people here in South Florida who don't have access to Wi-Fi or stable Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And so I think it requires, as best as we can, to have those direct conversations, direct outreach calls, and as best as we can, socially distance, having public meetings.
So imagine, Mina and James, that you have the kind of voice that you are advocating for in this process. What would you ask applicants in a job interview, Mina?
So I think the first question that comes to mind is, in what ways do they want to uplift the educator voice and understanding of what's happening in schools? I think having someone that's willing to have conversations, so neighborhood town halls, conversations with folks that are directly doing this work that is impacting our students.
James, how about for you? What would you ask a job applicant?
Well, outside of the criteria that's listed, I would ask them, how do they plan to govern a very diverse school district, and what is their relationship? What relationship do they want to have with community organizations and also directly with families ongoing? And the second thing would be, what are their thoughts on charter schools, and how are they making sense of the way charter schools have proliferated the state, and how are they navigating that? And then the third one is, how are they going to manage the political tensions at a school board level that is seemingly to be apolitical, and we know that that's no longer the case.
Interesting question, certainly. James Lopez, Executive Director of Power U, a nonprofit youth leadership development group here in Miami-Dade County. Mina Hosseini is the Executive Director of PS305, an education nonprofit in Dade County. Mina and James, thanks so much for sharing your voice to this. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Indeed. Happy New Year. We've got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. We're going to talk about how pedestrians became king of some roads in South Florida during the pandemic and why cars are returning to some of those streets. Share the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio in South Florida. The pandemic gave some power to pedestrians, bicyclists, even restaurants, moving tables out into streets that had been closed to cars and trucks during the worst of COVID-19. Now, some of those roads are welcoming traffic back, but not everyone wants that to happen. We saw this in Coconut Grove last year when many residents and business owners pushed to keep the one block of Fuller Street closed to cars. Now soon, automobiles and trucks will be driving again on Ocean Drive in Miami Beach. The street is scheduled to reopen for southbound traffic on January 24th, with a pedestrian plaza blocked off to cars. The city of Miami Beach is also planning a long-term urban redesign to make South Beach's Art Deco district more pedestrian-friendly. Bernard Sukovic is founder and CEO of Sukovic Architecture. He's been working with the city of Miami Beach, putting a team together to help plan and develop the redesign, starting with Loomis Park.
Our concept is that the park, which is a famous park, should actually, in its essence, actually begin to extend all the way into the city, down the side streets and all the way to Collins and to Washington Avenue. Because our idea of pedestrian and bike mobility, which is key, is really a district-wide situation, not just one street.
Now, he says that there are a lot of perspectives to keep in mind in the redesign of Ocean Drive, the iconic street stretches in about eight blocks.
With every single change in the way that we kind of regulate the activity of a city, there's always a consequence. We look at it from all of those points of view. Cities change, cities evolve, and we're trying to figure out how do we turn the dials in such a way that we get the best result.
So the power of pedestrians during the pandemic and some short stretches of streets and roadways in South Florida, some of those returning to traffic. 800-743-WLRN. What's your experience been like if you've seen some of these short stretches that have been taken over by walkers, bicyclists, rollerbladers, skateboarders, joggers, and now moving perhaps back to seeing some more automobiles? 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN, or join us on Twitter at WLRN. Sarah Holder is with City Lab and joins us now to talk more about the development. Sarah, thanks for your time today. Appreciate you joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
So describe some of the changes that are going to be happening on Ocean Drive in late January as cars and trucks will be welcomed back to part of the roadway.
Yeah, so for the past almost 2 years, Ocean Drive has been pedestrian first and car free. Starting at the end of the month at 6 a.m. on January 24th, the street will be reopened to one-way southbound traffic, but there will be some changes to the street that you knew before the pandemic. There will be two-way green bike lanes painted on. Soon they'll be protected, and there'll be one block of a pedestrian plaza where pedestrians can continue to enjoy the street without cars.
And so what's the justification been for this, for these changes?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, a lot of cities decided to open up some streets to pedestrians and to outdoor dining. There was an emphasis on hanging out outside.
Mm-hmm.
It was safer, more able to come together without the threat of infection. And also it allowed restaurants to expand their outdoor dining options into parking places and into the street where they were more limited before.
I'll share with you, about a year ago was the last time I was on Ocean Drive and it was closed, and I still found myself gravitating to the sidewalk. I found it difficult to walk in the street in an area that I was so used to having car traffic in.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I was just visiting Miami Beach right after Christmas, and I saw that it was pretty well used. You know, there were kids wandering around, skateboarders skateboarding back and forth, and bikers. So sometimes it takes the energy of the crowd to bring you into the middle of the street, maybe.
What about the economic impact of it? I mean, lots of foot traffic certainly increased. Now some vehicular traffic will be back. What are the businesses experience?
Yeah, well, like I said, the restaurants were able to expand their outdoor dining offerings, and I think that was a boon for their business and allowed more people than otherwise might be able to eat there. I think some hoteliers were a bit concerned with the fact that guests weren't able to bring their luggage right up to the lobby doors without cars or taxis being able to drop them off. But resort tax returns, according to city data, we're actually quite strong, especially in the first few months of this year and the last few months of last year. So it doesn't seem to have had a real detrimental impact, but there were still some concerns just about accessibility.
Yeah, Sarah, stick with us. Sarah Holder is with CityLab, a CityLab colleague, so to speak, of hers. Richard Florida is back with us on WLRN. Richard is a visiting fellow at Florida International University, well-known urbanist, and part-time Miami Beach resident. Richard, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you again.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be with you. Yeah. And I will say, read Sarah Holder and read CityLab. It's something I helped to create a long time ago. It's now at Bloomberg.
Yeah.
And it has some of the best urban and city reporting you'll ever come across. And Sarah's piece is delightful.
She's got a terrific piece on this reopening of Ocean Drive. But we've seen this, not Ocean Drive is you know, a high-profile example of pedestrians during the pandemic. But we've seen this happen in other places, Coconut Grove. We've also seen new urban areas created by real estate developers. I think of City Place in Doral. I think of even renewal of places like Clematis Street in West Palm Beach. What's happening here, Richard?
Well, I think the trend during the pandemic, let's take Ocean Drive out of this for a moment and come back to that, is to open up streets for things other than the car. If you really think about it, using a street in general to move cars around, not a very effective use of that street. I mean, it moves traffic, but that's valuable real estate. You can have restaurant seating. You can have outdoor, especially in a climate. You know, maybe right. It doesn't work in Toronto where I live the other part
yeah,
of the year.
Yeah,
but,
works in January.
You know, you can
in
have
the
bicycling.
Beach,
you can have pedestrian activity. You have excitement. You have energy. Think about, you know, Lincoln Road, if you, an example of this. And I think that communities across this country, and even more so communities in Europe during the pandemic said, this is fantastic. Think about New York with those incredible dining sheds. You know, we
but
can do things
an appetite for that
and
here
it's
in
safe. And by the way, I want to make this for our listeners. We talk a lot in the United States about vaccination and getting our third shot. Of course, I have my third shot, whether people like that or not. But ventilation is the proven COVID killer. You know, if you want to avoid viral diseases, ventilation is the number one go-to. So being outside is very safe.
Richard, sorry for the interruption.
That's been the big motivator here, getting people outside in a safe environment, you know, relatively free from the virus. And I think communities have and restaurants and shops and even offices and schools have grabbed onto that.
Richard, I've got less than a minute left, but I want you to just to address quickly as possible just the appetite for this in the car dominated transportation world that is South Florida.
Well, look, you know, this is in every city. The drivers are saying, I want my street back. But I think Ocean Drive is a unique case. And I think that was in part driven by the fear of what I would call euphemistically urban disorder, fighting, crime, drunken behavior. And I don't think the Ocean Drive decision can be separated out from that. I think that people said in local government here in the beach, look, we have another problem, which is called urban disorder or disarray. Putting cars back on the street may help temporarily hope to quell it. Hopefully we get back to Ocean Drive being more of a pedestrian and resident-friendly place. And hopefully this is a temporary measure.
Interesting connection. Richard, always a pleasure. Thanks for the short time today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thanks, Sarah, and everybody.
Indeed. Richard Florida, visiting fellow at Florida International University, well-known urbanist, and earlier Sarah Holder with CityLab. Sarah, thanks again for sharing your reporting with us as well. Finally on the roundup, the endearing and enduring nature of a local landmark. Reporter Nancy Klingener sent us this audio letter from Key West.
2022 began with the southernmost point on fire. Kind of. And it's not quite the southernmost point, anyway. Two guys set a Christmas tree on fire right next to the painted monument at the corner of South and Whitehead Streets. The buoy-shaped marker was charred, a big black scar smeared across its red, yellow, and black stripes. Key Westers were outraged. It's bad enough when Mother Nature defaces the marker. The southernmost point has been through a lot. Hurricane Irma scoured off a patch of the paint, leaving gray concrete exposed like a wound. Early in the pandemic, the city was worried about people getting too close to each other while waiting to take selfies at the marker, so it was unceremoniously cloaked in a blue tarp. People just took selfies with the shrouded landmark anyway. The simple striped monument is such a recognizable icon that it is everywhere. Keychains, koozies, and kites. At my house, we have a Southernmost Point salt and pepper shaker set and a Southernmost Point Christmas tree ornament. It's sort of an Eiffel Tower for Key West. If you've been to Key West, you probably have a picture of it in your photos. Like a lot of locals, lining up for a selfie with that hunk of concrete doesn't really appeal to me. I make snarky remarks about out-of-town TV crews who show up there when a hurricane threatens. But I like that it's there, and that it is undeniably ours, even if others try to imitate it. And even if it isn't really the southernmost point of the continental United States, the real southernmost point of the island is close by on Navy property, where they are doing high-security things in the vicinity of the Joint Interagency Task Force South. Selfies there are discouraged, and occasionally prosecuted. But that painted concrete buoy that is 500 feet farther north, it's tough, like when it takes a beating from a Category 4 hurricane, or a couple drunk dudes go after it with a Christmas tree and a lighter. Even those of us who will never stand in line in the hot sun for a photo with the southernmost point, and know that it's not actually the southernmost point on the island, we still know what it symbolizes. It's anchoring our little speck on the map, and we'll just keep fixing it up for those selfies. From the WLRN Southernmost Bureau at the studios of Key West, I'm Nancy Klingener.
And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week, produced by Natu Twe, engagement editor Katie Lepre, director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor, Peter J. Maris. Richard Ives answers the phones. A program made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, bee removal specialist.
WLRN Public Media.